Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and stories is designed for people learning English. So we speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today, Jonathan Evans reports on an old American tradition that is alive and well in the state of New Hampshire. Later, Alice Bryant brings us the Learning English program, Ask a Teacher, and we close the show with an American story. We will hear To Build a Fire by Jack London. But first, more than 100 years ago, the American government took control of the Hawaiian Islands and took away Native Hawaiians' land rights. Now, officials at the United States Civil Rights Commission are urging lawmakers to permit Native Hawaiians to establish their own independent government. But many Native Hawaiians reject the idea. They say they will not accept anything less than Hawaii's complete independence. And they say they want control of more than 400,000 hectares of the island's land. Sailors from Polynesia first settled the Hawaiian Islands around the year 400. For more than 1,000 years, the Native Hawaiians lived together in small groups, farmed and fished for their needs, and governed themselves. In the late 1700s, one Native leader overpowered the others and united the islands into a single kingdom. But in the early 1800s, the area changed sharply. Other groups came. Many Native Hawaiians died from the new diseases that came with the foreigners. Others were forced from their lands to permit the newcomers to create large sugarcane farms. American planters soon dominated the island's economy. In time, the planters, United States government officials, and Marines ousted from power Hawaii's last ruler, Queen Liliuokalani. In 1898, the U.S. government officially annexed Hawaii, and in 1959 named it the country's 50th state. Today, Native Hawaiians are only about 20% of the state's population. Nolani Goodyear Kaopua is an expert on Native Hawaiian social movements. She is also Native Hawaiian, or Kanaka Maoli. Kaopua says that Native Hawaiians have been protesting the loss of their rights and calling for sovereignty since the 1800s. But they do not always agree on what they are asking for. Some want to form a government and operate as a kind of nation within a nation, like Native American tribes on the U.S. mainland. Others want to be a country independent from the United States. In 2014, U.S. government officials held a number of hearings across Hawaii to learn what Native Hawaiians thought about forming their own government. A large majority of people who spoke in the hearings said they did not want it. Instead, they argued the U.S. violated international law when it removed the queen as ruler. The kingdom, they say, continues to exist. Yet in 2016, the U.S. government released a final rule to permit Native Hawaiians to form a government. In other words, the nation within a nation solution. Nolani Gujir Kaopua points out that the rule does not permit Native Hawaiians control of any land currently controlled by the U.S. government. How is this in any way to our benefit? She asks. We wouldn't even be getting the crappy deal that Native American nations have. And once you accept a lesser deal, a better deal is impossible. Another Hawaiian historian does not reject the U.S. government's offer completely. Baviana McGregor is a founding member of the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. She says the U.S. officially recognizing that Native Hawaiians have the right to govern themselves is an important step toward full independence. She says she hopes to see an independent Native Hawaiian government within an independent Hawaii. But, she says, she does not think it will happen in her lifetime.
In modern times, most people choose to use electrical devices, like refrigerators, to keep drinks cool. But summer visitors at Rocky Walled Deep Haven Camps in New Hampshire cool their drinks the old-fashioned way, using large blocks of ice in wooden boxes. Rocky Walled Deep Haven Camps first opened in the town of Holderness, New Hampshire in 1897. That year, workers and volunteers first began to get ice from nearby Squam Lake. Workers used tools such as saws and ice pikes to cut 200 tons of ice in a normal winter. They transport the ice to two storage buildings on the campgrounds, where it is kept until the summer. Then, workers provide the ice to camp guests, who place it in old ice boxes to keep drinks and food cold. Some of the ice boxes date back to the 1930s. Guests are told not to eat the ice, but some older guests still place a few pieces of the ice in their drinks. John Jerchinski has run the Rocky Walled Deep Haven Camps for 29 years. He also leads the ice harvest. He told the Associated Press, "Many of the families have been coming for generations, and people who come here don't like to see much change. They like it to be a simple, quiet place." Workers wait until the ice reaches a safe thickness, about 33 centimeters, before the harvest begins. They mostly use a device called an ice saw, a large round piece of metal with many sharp points. It cuts deeply as a powered sled moves it across the ice. The blocks of ice it makes can weigh as much as 54 kilograms. They are loosened with the help of chainsaws. Workers with tools called ice pikes guide the blocks along a narrow passage of water to land. There, the blocks are loaded onto a truck for a trip to the storage buildings. The group collects as many as 3,600 blocks of ice each winter. Dennis Picard is a former museum director in Massachusetts. He is considered an expert on ice harvesting. He told the AP that ice harvesting began in 1805. A man named Frederick Tudor came up with the idea of shipping ice around the world. Picard says at its peak, ice was shipped as far away as Asia. The ice harvesting business made Tudor millions of dollars. Picard added that tens of thousands of people were employed in the industry, mostly in the Northeast and Midwest. But ice harvesting declined after World War I. Gas-powered and electric refrigerators became more popular. Today, only a few places in North America continue to harvest ice for business purposes. Wine Lake Camp in Ontario, Canada does it, as well as several places in Wisconsin, Montana, and Maine. In the main town of South Bristol, the ice is sold and used to produce ice cream for a yearly ice cream party in July. Rockywald Deephaven is open to guests from June through the middle of September. In the past 122 years, the camp has never gone without an ice harvest. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You may remember last week's program in which I talked about rules of English word stress for two-syllable words. If you missed that program, take a few minutes to read and listen to it first, and then join us here. This week, we continue talking about word stress based on a question from our reader, Larisha. Hi again, Larisha. Let's begin with three-syllable words. Three-syllable words that end in ER and LY often stress the first syllable. Listen to some examples. Readily, quietly, perfectly, manager, gardener, busier. Note these words are a mix of adverbs, adjectives, and nouns. But the part of speech is not important here. We are focused on word endings. Next, words ending in IC, TION, and SION usually have their stress on the second to last syllable. This is true for words with three or more syllables. Listen carefully. Word meaning is not important here. Embryonic, catatonic, organization, rendition, permission, indecision. Several other word endings decide word stress. They are AL, GY, CY, TY, and PHY. For these, the stress is on the third to last syllable. That sounds complex, but it's easier than you think. For example, here is a word you've probably heard often. Photography. Listen to a few more. Entomology, democracy, physical, morbidity, autobiography. Keep in mind a few things as you learn and practice English word stress. First, some multisyllable words have two stresses. We call them primary stress, the main, louder stress, and secondary stress, the lower, softer stress. Take the word alligator. It has four syllables. The primary stress is on the first syllable, but the third syllable does have a softer secondary stress. Second, in English, we stress only vowel sounds. We do not stress consonants. For instance, in the word photography, I stressed the second vowel, ah. I said it louder and longer than the other vowels. Listen again. Photography. The unstressed syllables are low, fast, and often unclear. And that brings us to our last point. It may feel strange to say some parts of a word lower, quicker, and less clear than other parts, but with practice, it will begin to feel more natural. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
Our story today is called To Build a Fire. It was written by Jack London. Here is Harry Monroe with the story.
The man walked down the trail on a cold gray day. Pure white snow and ice covered the earth for as far as he could see. This was his first winter in Alaska. He was wearing heavy clothes and fur boots, but he still felt cold and uncomfortable. The man was on his way to a camp near Henderson Creek. His friends were already there. He expected to reach Henderson Creek by 6 o'clock that evening. It would be dark by then. His friends would have a fire and hot food ready for him. A dog walked behind the man. It was a big gray animal, half dog and half wolf. The dog did not like the extreme cold. It knew the weather was too cold to travel. The man continued to walk down the trail. He came to a frozen stream called Indian Creek. He began to walk on the snow-covered ice. It was a trail that would lead him straight to Henderson Creek and his friends. As he walked, he looked carefully at the ice in front of him. Once he stopped suddenly, and then walked around a part of the frozen stream. He saw that an underground spring flowed under the ice at that spot. It made the ice thin. If he stepped there, he might break through the ice into a pool of water. To get his boots wet in such cold weather might kill him. His feet would turn to ice quickly. He could freeze to death. At about 12 o'clock, the man decided to stop to eat his lunch. He took off the glove on his right hand. He opened his jacket and shirt and pulled out his bread and meat. This took less than 20 seconds, yet his fingers began to freeze. He hit his hand against his leg several times until he felt a sharp pain. Then he quickly put his glove on his hand. He made a fire, beginning with small pieces of wood and adding larger ones. He sat on a snow-covered log and ate his lunch. He enjoyed the warm fire for a few minutes. Then he stood up and started walking on the frozen stream again. A half hour later, it happened. At a place where the snow seemed very solid, the ice broke. The man's feet sank into the water. It was not deep, but his legs got wet to the knees. The man was angry. The accident would delay his arrival at the camp. He would have to build a fire now to dry his clothes and boots. He walked over to some small trees. They were covered with snow. In their branches were pieces of dry grass and wood left by floodwaters earlier in the year. He put several large pieces of wood on the snow under one of the trees. On top of the wood, he put some grass and dry branches. He pulled off his gloves, took out his matches, and lighted the fire. He fed the young flame with more wood. As the fire grew stronger, he gave it larger pieces of wood. He worked slowly and carefully. At 60 degrees below zero, a man with wet feet must not fail in his first attempt to build a fire. While he was walking, his blood had kept all parts of his body warm. Now that he had stopped, cold was forcing his blood to withdraw deeper into his body. His wet feet had frozen. He could not feel his fingers. His nose was frozen too. The skin all over his body felt cold. Now, however, his fire was beginning to burn more strongly. He was safe. He sat under the tree and thought of the old men in Fairbanks. The old men had told him that no man should travel alone in the Yukon when the temperature is 60 degrees below zero. Yet here he was. He had had an accident. He was alone. And he had saved himself. He had built a fire. Those old men were weak, he thought. A real man could travel alone. If a man stayed calm, he would be all right. The man's boots were covered with ice. The strings on his boots were as hard as steel. He would have to cut them with his knife. He leaned back against the tree to take out his knife. Suddenly, without warning, a heavy mass of snow dropped down. His movement had shaken the young tree only a tiny bit, but it was enough to cause the branches of the tree to drop their heavy load. The man was shocked. He sat and looked at the place where the fire had been. The old man had been right, he thought. If he had another man with him, he would not be in any danger now. The other man could build the fire. Well, it was up to him to build the fire again. This time, he must not fail. The man collected more wood. He reached into his pocket for the matches. But his fingers were frozen. He could not hold them. He began to hit his hands with all his force against his legs. After a while, feeling came back to his fingers. The man reached again into his pocket for the matches. But the tremendous cold quickly drove the life out of his fingers. All the matches fell onto the snow. He tried to pick one up, but failed. The man pulled on his glove and again beat his hand against his leg. Then he took the gloves off both hands and picked up all the matches. He gathered them together. Holding them with both hands, he scratched the matches along his leg. They immediately caught fire. He held the blazing matches to a piece of wood. After a while, he became aware that he could smell his hands burning. Then he began to feel the pain. He opened his hands, and the blazing matches fell onto the snow. The flame went out in a puff of gray smoke. The man looked up. The dog was still watching him. The man got an idea. He would kill the dog and bury his hands inside its warm body. When the feeling came back to his fingers, he could build another fire. He called to the dog. The dog heard danger in the man's voice. It backed away. The man called again. This time the dog came closer. The man reached for his knife, but he had forgotten that he could not bend his fingers. He could not kill the dog because he could not hold his knife. The fear of death came over the man. He jumped up and began to run. The running began to make him feel better. Maybe running would make his feet warm. If he ran far enough, he would reach his friends at Henderson Creek. They would take care of him. It felt strange to run and not feel his feet when they hit the ground. He fell several times. He decided to rest a while. As he lay in the snow, he noticed that he was not shaking. He could not feel his nose or fingers or feet. Yet he was feeling quite warm and comfortable. He realized he was going to die. Well, he decided he might as well take it like a man. There were worse ways to die. The man closed his eyes and floated into the most comfortable sleep he had ever known. The dog sat facing him, waiting. Finally, the dog moved closer to the man and caught the smell of death. The animal threw back its head. It let out a long, soft cry to the cold stars in the black sky. And then it turned and ran toward Henderson Creek, where it knew there was food and a fire.
That's our show for today, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.